Good morning, everyone. This is John Palfrey from Cambridge, Mass. Anybody on the line? I have to reveal yourself, but if you'd like to, this is a good time to do it, and it is being recorded.
Alan Enoy, American Library Association.
Thank you for joining.
Hi, Alan.
We're going to be starting officially in 7 minutes by my clock, I think we're being recorded as of now. I'm sorry. No, fine. Because we're not started, we're going to mute the line on this side until 9:45, just so that we don't get random discussion into the mix. You guys, this is being recorded right now. We're going to go on mute, but just if you're...
Harry Lewis.
Amy Ryan.
Hello.
My name is Richard Oroksar. I work for the National Park Service.
Tova Zeff. Hello?
Good morning, everyone. This is John Palfrey reporting in from Cambridge, Mass. Thank you to those who have joined. We heard Amy Ryan's nice voice come across and others. We are at 9:45.
This is Pam Wright from the National Archives and Records Administration.
Great, Pam. Welcome. We are now starting officially. We also are recording this call, so we are delighted to have you on the record if you are speaking up during the course of the meeting, but also please know that it will be recorded and then reposted. Since we are here in person with a good number of people, why don't we quickly go around the room to identify who's here. We've had lots of dings. We probably won't go everybody on the call, but if later on you do speak up, please do let us know who you are if you're willing. Maybe I'll start across from me with Paul Curran.
Hi, Paul Curran from the University of Michigan.
David Hansen.
Dwight McInville, Georgetown County Library.
Jerry McCann, University of Virginia.
Bob Darnton.
Maura Marks, DPLA Secretariat.
David North. David North.
Alfred Berkman Center.
Rebecca Haygack, Berkman Center.
Kenny Wakeblum, Berkman Center.
Zachary Davis, Independent.
Welcome, welcome. And may I ask just for those members of the steering committee who are joining by phone, I heard Amy, but are there other members of the steering committee on the phone? All right. Well, welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us. This is a couple-hour steering committee meeting, and we're very grateful to everyone who's been able to make time and those who are joining us, whether in person or from afar. Just in terms of the general approach here, we as a steering committee are in our second open meeting, and we're seeking to work the appropriate balance between getting a lot of work done and also being open to public participation. Our game plan here is to proceed through three big elements that we have on our plates. One is governance, two is the DPLA five-year plan, three is partnership agreements. I think everyone has seen this on the
Hi, it's Nancy Marin calling in from Ithaca.
Thanks, Nancy. What we're going to seek to do is to run through that as the steering committee, and then at 11:45 to 12:15 to have open discussion and time for public comment. If there are particular things that you would like to have raised to the steering committee before that time, please feel free to send me an email. If you'd like, I'll try to keep it open and to follow. We, I think, are not going to open things up before that time for kind of broad discussion. If there are pauses or moments where I can do that, I will. But generally speaking, we're going to focus on public discussion and commentary in the the final half hour or so. But again, I'll try to work in comments as we go. And obviously, please feel free to use the discussion list broadly for reactions and so forth, and we'll be following that as well. So that is the overall game plan. Thanks, everyone, again, for joining. I don't think there's more that we need to say by way of welcome unless anybody would like further welcome. So my view is we will push straight into the governance topic, which is the first on the list. And if I might, I'm just going to give a little bit of grounding and then throw the discussion open to the members of the steering committee. The bidding, we have established through the governance work stream and then through the steering committee in April a game plan to establish a new 501c3 and second to hire a new executive director. May I just, as a point of order, if anyone is on the call, if you wouldn't mind muting, we're getting some feedback here in the room, so if you wouldn't mind muting, that'd be great, and then if you're going to please do. Thank you so much. So the things that are established are that we're going to create this new organization and hire a new executive director. There are a few things that we have discussed and we want to affirm today, which include setting up a nominating committee to establish a new board for this organization, and second, a search committee to hire a new executive director and to get that search underway, and to begin the process of identifying what should be in the charter and bylaws and so forth for this new organization. We're not going to negotiate out a charter and bylaws today. That will be kicked over to the governance work stream as its next order of business, but we can give some guidance on that. But I do think that the important topic of discussing who would be on the nominating committee and who would be on the search committee is something we should discuss today, and we can give a few more details about our plans for that. Ideally, we would get this done by the end of the calendar year.
Hi, this is Toby Greenwald from Stokey Public Library.
The organization would be up and running by December 2012, if at all possible, with a handoff from the Berkman Center by April 2013, and ideally a candidate at least would have been identified, if not signed up by that point, too, for executive director. That may be ambitious, but that's the kind of operating plan, so we can have a good handoff. So that's one big issue. And
hi, this is Peter Lowe.
The other piece that I want to put on the table for discussion is the notion of where a new organization might be cited, as in as some of the suggestions that I noted by email to the list have included so far Chicago, Boston, San Francisco, and others. So that's the big kind of slate of topics that we have on the table for this 45 minutes or so. And we thought we would open this up for discussion by the board. And my suggestion would be that for the steering committee, we start with the idea of the nominating committee. We move to the notion of the search committee. And then we discuss the potential place as things that I'd love to get really good, crisp guidance from the steering committee on before we move ahead. So maybe if we could start with the notion of a nominating committee and with the premise that presumably people joining a nominating committee would not themselves likely be members of the board, so that we don't have a conflict. But this, let me put this suggestion in this process forward and get thoughts on either individuals or criteria for people who might be on another.
David Rothman.
Welcome, David. Thank you.
Hey, it's great to be there, and thanks for having this remote.
That's one thing, and people could make that, they could volunteer later on, I mean, you know, soon.
Absolutely.
By email, you wouldn't have to do it right away.
Right.
I have a question about the nature of the nominating committee. Should we, we've always used the principle of not having representativeness, not thinking of constituents that are represented on the steering committee, et cetera. However, we might want on the nominating committee people from major organizations.
Thank you, Bob. And pick that up. Just to note, the microphones are these little black spots on the table. So if you can speak for us.
Emily Gore.
Okay, so a first suggestion is the matter of
Trina Steerholt.
We're delighted to have so many people on. The room is chiming with the entrances. Great, Bob. So topic one is on the nominating committee for a new board. Jordan suggested that some members of this committee might say that they would like to be on that and would therefore not be on the board itself. And we can set up a web form so people can make suggestions of those names. And Bob has forwarded a helpful related suggestion, which we could take up as well, which is to say we don't seek representativeness so far on the steering committee, but certainly we would like to have some broad, diverse representation ultimately on the board, and that should be reflected, if at all possible, in the nominating group as well.
So this is Amy chiming in on that one. I think it's good to have a diverse group representing different types of institutions, but that they have a broad view. So, for instance, I wouldn't want to feel I speak for public libraries, but I speak with a certain expertise of public libraries, but see the broader picture.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you in particular for joining us from vacation, which is
Monday. That's right. That's
happened on that time. Thank you. It certainly seems like a good premise that having a broad view is crucial.
I also think, on the nominating committee, we should have at least one person from Berkman. In other words, some continuity in terms of what we've been doing and understanding the culture of this as it's developed or evolved over the past 2 years would be helpful. So, are you?
I'd be happy to do that as someone who's not putting themselves up for the.
Or you might just speak into the mic, sir. Sorry, Chris.
Sorry, I was just saying I'd be happy to do that to provide the continuity, as I'm not seeking to be on the board of the thing. So
good. So let's keep you. Yeah. So let's.
I think more as a lead candidate for a member.
I think that it gives us that continuity that we need.
So let me just. I'm trying to solve the dynamic program problem the other way. So the purpose of the nominating committee is to nominate members of a board whose purpose is then to be considerably more active than the steering committee has been. And the immediate first thing the board does basically is probably select an executive director.
Exactly.
Right. So we actually want to move quite quickly because I think getting that in place. And so the board is less diffuse, more powerful, more willing to both cause offense and enthusiastic response in the communities than the steering committee has been.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So you're trying to figure out who I want on. That should then translate back to what flavor of a nominating committee
you
want.
You have
the base of the triangle to the.
Nailed the dynamic. I think this is a very important fraud concept that Paul is highlighting, which is I think we have started with an extremely, extremely open, broad call for ideas and people and so forth, and that as we get closer and closer to April 2013 and to a new organization, there's a narrowing process we're going through, and by necessity that means fewer people making sort of quicker decisions and potentially more offensive decisions to some, as Paul puts it. I think the process of getting to a board is part and parcel of that, exactly.
And of course, the board will need bylaws and procedures, and there's a lot to be worked on. But it's becoming urgent because we need someone to assume that responsibility. Does the nominating committee nominate members of the board, or does it actually choose them? And if it only nominates, who does the decision?
At least my own thinking is we have a governance issue of turtles all the way down in this particular instance. We have no option in this way. I would seek for the nominating committee to come up with a slate of people for the board and to have the to reflect on that. And if there is not, if there's some reasonable consensus, if not, we do have to figure out a tie-breaking, approach, which, I think we've tried to avoid through this process. But if we get there, I think we as the chair or with vice chairs or others, we'll have to find a mechanism for doing that reasonably and moving forward. So, but we have so far strived not to go down that route.
How large a board should it be?
That's an important question. Okay.
Well, how large a board and how large a nominating committee? Again, these are connected.
Well, the nominating committee should help decide. So I think we discussed maybe 5 people on the nominating committee, something of that nature.
As members of the nominating committee.
I think a relatively small nominating committee, and obviously I think initially a board that is smaller than the steering committee, because we plainly want to have a more, as you suggested, directive and immediately involved board than we've had. It may over time re-expand to something closer to the steering committee size, but I guess maybe let me throw out a heuristic, the possibility of having 5 people as nominators and then have that group come back with something that looks like a similarly sized board, maybe it's 5 to 7 members, depending on what they come up with. And may I please just ask those who have joined the call, if you wouldn't mind muting, we're hearing some people typing on their computers and so forth, that would be great, thank you.
And John, do we want to say try to have 2 or 3 people from the steering committee on the nominating board, and then look outside for a couple more to help us?
Yes, I think in conversations with the governance work stream, which has been talking about various aspects of this at different points, the notion of having both some people from the steering committee and a few people who are not, I think, is a good idea. We're continually expanding our community in various ways. I think that is a good thing. So. For the nominating committee, we have, say, 3 people from the steering committee and a couple who are not, just as a possibility. Just some amount of continuity as well as some amount of growing seems to me a good.
Should we set a date by which people should submit names and we would decide who the nominate and then float it to the steering committee and decide who the nominating committee is?
Yep, I think that's right. I want to make sure that this group thinks the general approach is right, which I'm...
I'm not quite sure. I mean, there really is, and the turtle's all the way down this right, there's really no constitution here at all. Do we imagine that the nominating committee will nominate a single slate of 5 or 6 or 7 people, or a larger slate from which somebody would pick, but there's no one to pick? And in fact, I note that there are surely members of the steering committee who will be candidates for the board. Not surely. It's likely that there are members of the steering committee who will be candidates for the board. So that puts the steering committee as a not terrific choice unit for figuring out who's on the board, just to complicate things further, which may make it that having the nominating committee be charged with pick a slate, is the best way to go.
That's my view, that they come back with a slate and we look at it from a view to, is this a reasonably representative group? Now, this is not having people stand in as strict representatives for communities, but does it reflect a broad sense of diversity, which I think is something we've said many times is quite important, balance between public libraries and private libraries, racial diversity, ethnic diversity, geographic diversity, that I think those would be some watchwords that we would want to give to the nominating committee.
And procedurally, why not over the next day or two solicit names and then have the steering committee vote on a set of names and then see if some of those names are people who are not, find out whether they would be willing to serve. What about, that seems to me the simplest way to do it.
I think something like that. I was thinking we would give a week for people to suggest names, and I think if people are making suggestions, if they wouldn't mind sounding out the people so it's not completely cold, would you welcome being nominated, for instance?
And would the list of names be for the nominating committee or for the...
I think nominating committee for... Maybe people can... We could set up a web form. Kenny, is this... Am I speaking out of school, or can we set up easily a web form that would be suggest names for a nominating committee, suggest names for the board itself?
And the board would choose its own chair, presumably.
The nominating committee?
No, once a board is elected, it would choose its chair, I assume.
I think that's a reasonable mode.
So the nominating committee is not looking for a chair, but they just, because it will be important for a strong commitment on the part of the members of the board with frequent meetings and assuming a lot of responsibility.
Yep. Great. So we have at least one nomination for nominating, which is Maura Mark, which is fabulous. We will set up, people should, of course, feel free to float names on the various lists, but we will set up a formal mechanism for people suggesting names for the nominating committee on a web form on the DPLA site, and we will set a deadline of a week from today, which puts us at 6/19, moving with some urgency toward that. We will then seek to give a charge from the steering committee to that group of nominators, and then we will likewise give them a deadline for establishing the board. We are in parallel going to be setting up the new organization, of course, that they would then be the board members of. So that's a we're into parallel processing here. And to Paul's point, we would then turn to the search committee for an executive director thereafter. I think it's common in a search committee also to have people who are both board members of the organization and others. So my hunch would be that we would then turn, ideally in the month of July, to the process of establishing the search committee with a couple of board members and a couple of not also on that. Just so we have a sense of our plan from the Secretariat, we will be supporting that search from here. We hope people will already be thinking of executive director candidates and will be discussing them. We'll establish a basic job description and so forth for it. Our intention is to work with a consultant on that, whether it ends up being an individual or a firm, search firm. We will work on that over time. We've talked to a few people who would be interested or doing some sort of light consulting help us. We've talked in particular to Maureen Sullivan, who is the incoming president of the ALA, but who in her personal capacity might do some consulting to support us. She's an HR consultant by background, so we're likely to work with her. If people have a view on whether we ought to go from there or retain a central career, they have a formal firm for executive director, there'll be time to discuss that, but I just throw that out there as kind of our thinking, but the Secretariat will be doing the legwork in that respect.
I want to toss something in which isn't quite on point, but it will be. So I have found with small boards, which are by far the preferable kind, because they're much more agile and you can actually get half of them together for one phone call, it's very useful to augment the board and have subcommittees of the board that have full members who are not members of the board. Mm-hmm. So I'm just tossing that over, lobbing that over the wall to when this board organizes itself to be thinking along those lines.
I think it's a great suggestion. No, but they're full members of the subcommittee, but they're not members of the board. I think this is a great suggestion, in part so that we can ensure that we have continued the engagement of lots of people who wish to be engaged, while also not having such an unwieldy process, and we're obviously trying to narrow from a pretty unwieldy process.
And also having expertise. A board of six isn't going to have a sufficient range of expertise.
Now, I think that's important. Should we think of a tentative number of board members? I mean, there's a consensus, I gather, about having a fairly small board.
Five to seven. I've thrown out five to seven, but I think that's a good number. I'm throwing it out for discussion.
I'm seconding that.
And we're all saying small board. Sounds like nobody's saying huge board for starting.
Maybe seven rather than five, with the possibility over the years of it evolving.
I would imagine, as with any organization, that it will necessarily evolve and almost certainly evolve upwards. But I think early days, I agree. So.
Well, maybe for the very early days, five is better than seven. I don't know. I'd kind of like to have a number. So it should be an odd number.
Yes, odd is good. Odd is good. Regrettably, odd is good.
My guess is that the effort for five will fail and it will wind up being seven.
I have to say the reason I was throwing a five to seven was five sounds good and is probably going to be impossible given the diversity that we're seeking, and we'll probably end up at seven. But that means it doesn't go from seven to nine if you set it at five to seven.
Agreed.
All right. Does anybody dissent as to this broad view? Okay, great. Maybe let's turn to the topic of place, if that's okay. So let me review the bidding across a bunch of different conversations and kind of bring it into the room here. There are two general views. One general view is we ought to choose the place with a view toward sending a signal about the organization, what it's seeking to do, and stick with that as the home for the organization. The other view is, on the other end of the spectrum, we care a lot about who the executive director is, and we want to be sure that that person is the best candidate, is going to lead the organization, and that's more important than the place. And I think there's kind of an intermediate position in between the two, which is to say we nominally choose a place, Chicago, Boston, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, or some that have been thrown out there, but we say this is just a working hypothesis, and if the successful candidate for executive director must be in L.A. for some reason, or these are just using random things, Kansas City, in honor of Rebecca Haycock beside me, that, you know, the board will be open to that that kind of a change. I'm going to start with that middle premise, as in, does it make sense to start in this place where we have a notional headquarters, but have the flexibility to adjust it based upon who the executive director would be. The formal effect of that is almost certainly that we would establish the nonprofit in the state of Delaware for flexibility purposes, which is long made it easy for organizations to operate anywhere and to do so flexibly and to change themselves flexibly. Some states, including Massachusetts, sometimes make it actually quite hard to make such changes over time. So let me just throw that out there as an operating premise, and also welcome suggestions as to potential places, whether as the firm answer or the notional answer.
I like the idea of making it, because you want this to be a small, lean organization, executive director is going to be absolutely critical. So to me, it's almost unless people want to exclude certain places and just say under no circumstances we want it to be here or there. But beyond that, I don't see it name our slate of six preferred places, and it still won't be binding if the ideal candidate turns out to want to base it somewhere else and make a case for that.
I think Delaware is perfect because it's actually everywhere and nowhere, right? Extremely unlikely. It's perfectly possible the executive director might be, you know, from Newark, Delaware, and want to live there, but it's unlikely. But by saying Delaware, we say we're not picking it. And the director and the board will recognize that place has symbolic importance. Okay, they'll recognize that and work it out when they come to it. I must say, some people have said, not Washington. Well, maybe Washington, right? It'd be really great if the federal government were interested in these problems. So I don't want to say not anything, but recognize the most important thing will be the effective management of the organization, and that will have a lot to do with where the executive director wants to be. And we'll recognize that where this thing is matters. But I wouldn't go past that at this point.
Amy, Ryan, I know you've had views on this. I just want to acknowledge, I know sometimes it's hard to jump in. If you do want to jump in, we welcome your thoughts.
John?
Or others?
Amy, while waiting for Amy, Paul, would you therefore say, let's make the choice of place to follow the choice of executive secretary and not to have a kind of tentative list of most favorite places.
So, John, excuse me.
Oh, no problem, Amy.
Oh, so I was getting my mute off. I was so conscientious about my mute.
So, nice.
So I am not the one on my computer. I actually think since this is such an innovative new adventure and venture that the structure, any structure that we can give it, I think would help. And it seems like, to me, there's a continuity in having it in Boston where there are the people who have started it up, and it's there's a certain flow because the director is going to have such a big job to do that I think it's almost too big a decision to leave to a new director who we think is going to be great. But if the, you know, we've all made hiring mistakes once in a while, even though we probably won't this time.
You,
I think
Amy,
there's too much.
It.
Well, just so you don't say it was my board that made the mistake, John. So I just think that the Berkman Center has been such a strong partner that to me, other places seem arbitrary, at least for the first 2 years or something. And I think the board's going to want to I don't think the board wants to be up to the personal opinion of a new director. So that's, I think it should be Boston, Cambridge, or somewhere, so there's the continuity at least for the first couple of years.
I mean, my view is that it's not that it's completely up to the executive director, but it would be the board and the executive director could negotiate it as part of the hiring, whereas limiting it in some way is premature. But
I can easily imagine people we'd really want who are quite tied down to the location that they're in, and I'd hate to rule people out on that basis. The argument for Boston is a very good one. Mm-hmm. It's also a very good symbolic argument about public libraries in this country. So the Rolodex in my head goes through possible executive directors. One of them lives in San Francisco and couldn't be moved. And there may be others like that, too.
Ooh, I'm thrilled that you've got the Rolodex going, Paul. You are.
Well, I think in that case, it could be that the headquarters could be, say, in Boston, and the person could continue to live in San Francisco but commute to board meetings or something like that. I mean, it doesn't have to be, if the headquarters are a certain place, it doesn't have to be that the person lives there, but that would be the headquarter at least several days a month or something.
But we will have a staff. I mean, we have learned that the day-to-day work with very capable people like Rebecca and others is crucial. And so I would think that, you know, having a really crack executive director surrounded by a staff which will be perhaps minimal at first but really very active and doing things every day would be crucial. In that sense, location matters.
Amy, in terms of your idea, to me the most important part of it is that maybe in the first year or two, wherever the executive director is based, they will need to have contact with Berkman and you know, and DC.
Uh-huh.
There could be, if it's the person's in San Francisco, we will make a certain number of trips and interaction with Berkman to make sure that they're really up to speed. But I don't think we want to say the headquarters has to be here at this stage.
And this is why we built into the plan that, you know, we plan a long transition. We hope to identify this person by the end of this year, ideally, and then we have, you know, a number of months where we from the Secretariat would like to help this person along. So,
I appreciate the sentiment behind it in all respects. This is John speaking. I think I speak for all of my colleagues, Rebecca and Maura and Kenny Whitebloom, who some of you may not have met, but is working more actively on the project, having graduated library school, that we all are completely committed to this. The game plan, of course, is to spin it out of the Berkman Center and to have an executive director who is not one of us, but we're completely committed to its effective handoff over a period of time. So we'll, one way or another, we will do our piece in that respect. Other views, Bob, I'm sorry, I think I effectively cut you off when you were asking Paul a follow-up question, because I was trying to recognize Amy.
Yeah, no, my follow-up question was, what comes first? And Paul was indicating he thought that the key thing was the choice of a top executive director and the location should follow. Myself, I don't have a strong view, but I'm quite persuaded by that. I also, however, like a notional headquarters that could be modified depending on the executive director. I think symbolically that's important. Symbolically, I'm very, myself, partial to the Midwest and Chicago. But I'm also persuaded by Amy's remarks about Boston and continuity. So I think those would, for me at least, be the top two.
What about a position? Sorry, I should actually let Paul answer that before I suggest a position. Go ahead. A way to operationalize this might be the following, would be to say to those of us who are going to set up the org, establish it in Delaware for the purpose of flexibility, and then in the posting put a few places that have been discussed by the steering committee as strong possibilities, Chicago and Boston if we want to put a couple of others on there, and note those and the reasons for them in our job posting for the executive director, and then as I think ultimately Paul was suggesting, leave it to the new board to determine this. I mean, it may also be that there's critical mass of where the board is. I don't know. You could imagine a variety of things that might emerge. I'm trying to see if I can find more or less consensus in the room that we could operationalize.
I think that's a good idea, John. because I think a lot of the success of the executive director is going to be rest on the board and supported by the board.
Yep.
So if they're all in Chicago, if most of them are in the Midwest, then it does make sense. So that's, I think that's actually a good position.
Is anybody uncomfortable with this sort of intermediate position? We seem to be doing non-offensive intermediate solutions generally, Paul.
No, but that's fine. No, that's actually, we're actually going to have a structure that's going to have to make the choices.
Choices, right.
We're in a hurry to make the choices, yeah. So I'm not worried about that at all.
Good. Okay. Good. Let me pause here 30 minutes or so into this discussion. We've actually, I think, resolved quite a few good things, but I don't know if there's anyone who is on the call, not on the steering committee, who wants to make any comment at this stage. We're generally speaking going to have reserved 30 minutes at the end, but if there's anything urgent anyone wants to pipe in, the line is open, and please tell us who you are.
David Curry, just a comment to resonate with the last observations that the more expeditious the group is in board, the better centered the decision making will be on location and many other items. So it seems like the movement towards establishing the board will empower the appropriate group to make many of the decisions going forward. So thanks.
Great, David, and thank you in particular for your extremely good commentary in the governance work stream online and otherwise.
No. So I have one thought on the board now that we're talking about the executive director, that it could be that initially we only pick five board members, wait to see who the executive director is from, and then pick the other two. In other words, you want some board members who are geographically, because the whole locus will shift. So it could be that we want a little flexibility in terms of, since we won't know if it's going to be East Coast, West Coast, Midwest. Just a thought.
Yep. It's two players to be named later. Sorry to go to sports metaphors, but I'm incurable that way. Sorry. Anyone else from the phone who might like to pipe in? Great.
Yeah, it's Matt Burrows. I'm a I'm an attorney, and my comment on the subject is, I like the idea of Delaware as a state of incorporation, but that should be treated distinct from the principal place of business for the organization. I think it can be handled in two separate steps.
Yep, so attorney to attorney, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Yep.
Absolutely. So the idea of Delaware was not to put a thumb on the scale in favor of situating in Delaware, but not to preclude it, as Paul mentioned. Well said. All right, so I'm going to close back up the line. Let me see if I can restate clearly what we've discussed, and if I've gotten any of it wrong or there's sort of a lack of fidelity to jump in. We've affirmed the idea of moving ahead with a nominating committee and eventually, although on a slightly longer timeline, a search committee, that we are welcoming for the next week between now and the 19th of June. We'll set up a web form online and we can receive them by email, notions of members for this nominating committee. We would aim for, roughly speaking, five nominators, likely three from the steering committee, two not from the steering committee. Job of these nominators will be to come up with a single slate of members for a founding board of a DPLA Inc. as a nonprofit. We would aim for a variety of forms of diversity in that board, including public and private libraries, geographic diversity, racial and ethnic diversity, and so forth, to reflect America. We would be open, as Paul Courant said, to the possibility later of adding subcommittees to the board, which would include people who are full members of the subcommittees but not members of the board, to ensure that we have some breadth of participation and expertise and so forth, that just being on, not being on the founding board doesn't mean you're not in a board-related capacity. We aim for 5 to 7 board members initially. It is more likely that we will aim for 5 and then potentially add 2 to Bob's, but that we could have a slate of up to 7. Ideally, there will be a consensus in the nominating committee. They will nominate a brilliant board, and that brilliant board will be accepted by unanimous consensus at the steering committee. If not, we will have to figure out a tie-breaking mechanism where we invoke various other forms of authority that we'll determine later. But that's the game plan, and we would hopefully have this group identified within a month or so, which is an ambitious but I think important timeline if we're going to try to get the organization really up and running by the end of the year, end of the calendar year. That's point one. As to place that we will move forward with establishing the 501c3 in the great state of Delaware, but only as a matter of form, and with the notion of where the place is left somewhat TBD by the new board. We will note a few suggestions from the steering committee. Chicago, Boston, D.C., and San Francisco have gotten various forms of nods in this conversation. We'll accept other notes. I'm sorry, Kansas City, yes, exactly. We've invoked Kansas City as
Lawrence,
well.
Kansas.
Lawrence, Kansas, getting more precise for Rebecca Hickok purposes. The board will be, you know, the new board will be charged with the ultimate decision of that on that basis in conjunction with the determination of who the executive director might be. I'm going to suggest that we put a bow around those decisions, but pause for a moment if there are any objections.
I have one tiny, that was very pithy and totally to the point. I agree with everything you said. Tiny, tiny tweak. We already have Maura as on the nominating committee, so in a way we want to nominate two members of the steering committee and two from that,
very
right?
Good. That's good. I mean,
that's
I think
good.
We've, I guess we could
unless
decide now that Maura,
to her,
yeah, I think Maura on the nominating committee would be
seeking
fantastic,
names.
Great.
Yeah.
Or as a steering committee member who does not wish to serve on the board.
Right. So we just
great. Okay.
Like
so we're looking
two,
ideally
two.
To have two more members of the steering committee who do not wish
thank
to be
you.
On the board. And thank you to Maura for that nomination. Plus two members of the nominating committee who are not on the steering committee and also do not wish to serve on the founding board.
So we're settled that five is the right number of the nominating committee. That was that
yeah.
I didn't remember where that.
That was
that
only
from.
Something I threw
we
out.
We're talking
so.
About the board. I mean, I think it should be
yeah.
small.
Okay.
We'll see who gets nominated for it, who volunteers in this process. I just wouldn't want to fix us at five, although I wouldn't want it to be very large.
A nominal number of five, and then
maybe we should have a conference call once we see what the results
see what
are.
The
and
nominations look like for nominators. Good. Yeah. That was just my, again,
no,
my
we
strong,
talked about it briefly.
Person.
We talked about a couple internal and two external, but... All good.
If I could make a comment, even though the comment from the field period was a few minutes ago, this is Kate Nevins with Lyrisys down in Atlanta, and I'm sorry I came in late, so I needed to hear the recap before I made my point in case you had already addressed this. I would just like to voice a little bit of concern about a startup board that's only five people. And the reason that I say that is I think we all need to be aware of the evangelical role of board members and also the need for DPLA to have a high level of visibility across the various communities. And I've always thought of board members, in addition to the important work they do, providing that evangelical invisibility. So I would just recommend that you all in your deliberations consider either is that the right number for now or is that the right number for the near term and maybe you'd want to expand once the board is up and running.
Thank you, Kate. Well put. And I think I sense that Paul's notion of some strong subcommittee members who are not board members to being along the similar lines of thinking.
Okay.
So that's a helpful suggestion.
Great. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for chiming in, and thank you to Lyrisys for its effective partnership already. We look forward to much more through this process.
So do I. Thank you so much.
All right. So I'm going to suggest that we move on from governance to the DPLA five-year plan. In fact, a few minutes ahead of schedule. Is there any topic that anyone had on governance steering committee members that was not brought up in this
segment.
Just one thing, the search committee for the executive director, I'm not clear as to the mechanism for that.
I think that my view is that that needs to be a fast follower onto having the board established, and again, that should have a few members of the new board and a few members not on the new board, and I feel like we won't be able to sort that group out until we've gotten the board of the new organization set up. So just if we think about staggering processes, but I think it's a very helpful point because people might think of candidates for the search committee who would not be candidates for the board, right, or nominating committee for the board, because someone on the search committee could be on the board but not a candidate for executive director as well.
My understanding was that the search committee was going to be generated by the board.
I think the board does need to generate. I think the board needs to own that higher, completely. And
the emphasis on fast follower is on fast.
Yes, fast for sure. Yeah. We did talk about parallel processing. We are developing that job description now, so that I think we can have the job description floating around to the executive director even when the search committee hasn't yet, at least as a draft, so that people could start thinking about candidates.
And people should be submitting names. Yeah. We've already put out feelers. I've heard of some people. Paul, we should definitely.
Mental Rolodex is going.
People should. It should. It's starting now.
Will those names be coming to this committee?
Maybe when we set up our form, Kenny might put a box for suggest people who might be good executive director candidates. We'll share those periodically with the steering committee as appropriate. All right. Pushing along to the second topic, if you have your agendas in front of you, the first big topic was governance. Second is the DPLA five-year plan. The subtopics are the priorities between now and April 2013, what the April 2013 launch looks like, and then what are the DPLA's priorities for the months and years after the launch. Again, to review the bidding a little bit, I think everybody has in front of them, who's here in the room, a printout of it that's been circulated also on the list, an initial spreadsheet with some ideas for this. We have, of course, had a working plan for now to April 2013 that is what the funders agreed to fund. Thank you to Doran Upsilon and the Arcadia Foundation in particular. The things that we have agreed to at a high level to the funders, which I feel like I need to state now clearly, so these are fixed, are that we would have three things in particular done by April 2013. One is a working prototype of the DPLA. This is something that we have obviously talked a good deal about and is in the purview of the technical aspects workstream and the interim tech development team. We'll certainly talk more about that now. Two is that we would have a demonstration, at least one, of what a DPLA could look like. We specified the Europeana partnership as a relatively curated version of that, which is in particular supported by the Arcadia grant that's well underway, and Maura can speak to that as needed later. We hope to outperform in the sense of having more than just the Europeana exhibit in the system by DPLA, April 2013, but that's what we committed to from a funding perspective. And then third is to have a work plan, a game plan for what the DPLA would do after its formal launch in April 2013, which in essence is what we're talking about now with this document and all of our organizational discussions as well. So that's what we must get done, and we've circulated a document that talks about those things as well. I want to recognize also Chuck Henry, Mike Keller, and Jerry McGann, who sent a note to the steering committee saying that they felt we should be working on a five-year plan as opposed to the kind of 10-month plan that we've been hyper-focused on here at the Secretariat. We're grateful to them and hope that they will continue to take up the work. I think they volunteered, in fact, to work on it and to lead it. So what we're doing today, in a way, is we're handing over from the Secretariat to the steering committee and to these three guys where we think the work plan is as of this moment, and want to kick around any aspects of this that people would like to discuss. There are a couple I know that in hearing the agenda, Bob Darton in particular has highlighted that he'd like to put on the table, but that's our topic for the next probably 45 minutes or so before we get to partnership agreement. So let me pause there and open for comments by the steering committee on the five-year plan.
This is Brewster.
Hey,
who would be on the five-year plan committee?
Well, so far, Jerry and Chuck and Mike have self-nominated. If you would like to self-nominate, we'd love to have your help.
I'd love to help.
Great.
Yay, Brewster.
Good, good. This was a steering committee initiative that came just across the list. So we're delighted to have the help. I think one overall thing that I mentioned earlier, Brewster, is, and I'm sorry that we're getting you on the line at 7:30 your time, a.m. Thank you for that. Was the notion that in this next 10 or 11 months that we're needing to sort of go from the 20 person-ish steering committee size down to some smaller groups and smaller units that can operate more quickly. So I think this five-year plan is a good way to do that.
Part of the reason Chuck and Mike and I were discussing this was because we felt there was such a disconnect between the different work streams. In particular, the key work stream, in my opinion, I think of Chuck's and Mike's as well, which is the technical development work stream. I don't really have a good sense of where they are or when they're going to come in with a model for what the underlying structure of the technical service will be. You all must be able to talk about this right now.
We certainly can. I want to make sure that, do we want to drill to that level and just jump right into the tech development piece of the work plan?
Oh, you missed the last plenary.
Yeah, I couldn't, but I did read the notes, and I still didn't have a good sense of for example, I have, following the outline here, it looks to me like 7/27 is a crucial date for having in place a technical model that will go into a demonstration of its capabilities, or is that not true?
I think it is true. So let me make sure that everybody knows what exists and where we stand, because obviously a lot of the West Coast plenary was just on this score. There also is the DPLA Dev Wiki, which has extensive technical overview, including a scope and a spec, which is, I think, fairly consistently updated, and I think actually has had lots of good input from the community broadly. If going into the tech overview document, which we can put up on the screen here, but is the broad technical
that
plan.
Is what has been decided on.
I think this has been the operating plan, and we've continued to operate against it. The overall state of technology development. Let me kind of give the foot view, and then we can come back to the specifics. Is that both the scope and the spec have been developed and shared publicly and refined over the last several months. A very small group of developers and a few consultants have developed the kind of technical architecture and background that has been both published and then demoed in San Francisco. We have focused on architecture, plumbing type stuff initially, and no focus yet on the front end on purpose. Where we stand now is the need to shift from this interim technology development team that is focused only on backends and publishing scopes and specs to a group that is going to combine the finishing of that backend, but the emphasis on the front end and the experience that people will have when they come in April 2013. So through a series of workshops that will happen between now and the end of July, there are a series of use cases that have been published as well, which I hope everybody has seen, which are what will people experience as they walk through the DPLA. Nate has particularly been focused on this and has published them several times. We're then going to move into a mode where we need to identify some people who will do front-end development with this back-end technology development team, and that will guide the build between now and April 2013. So where I would describe our moment, the way I would describe our moment is the shift in the next month from a group of very small group of people who have been developing just back end and focusing on metadata to focusing on this user experience, refining these use cases, turning that into a you know, a design for a front end, and then an iterative process where the front end and back end teams are ensuring that we have something by April 2013. There will be, of course, this goes to our third topic, but there'll be continued discussion with content partners to ensure that we can ingest content so that the experience, again, in April 2013, the end all be all. Somebody's making some great noises on the phone. This will make for a good recording. By April 2013, we will have some of our partners' content into the DPLA, not all of it. I don't want to make expectations
right.
too high. But I think what we've discussed in the West Coast meeting and otherwise is that we'll have a series of different types of content that will be in the system and able to be used as a series of gestures to what the DPLA could be. And we aim for some pretty good experiences at that stage.
And just one more detail, you know, this Friday there's a workshop in Washington that's hosted by DLF that's bringing together members of the digital library community to look at the scope again. So we're constantly vetting, bringing together the tech work stream now more with content people. We're planning another workshop for August 6th in San Francisco or in San Diego to continue on the tail of that work. So I think we all recognize that San Francisco was the moment when the work streams went from working more in a siloed way to really coming together. We needed them to get launched somehow. And so this is a moment where we're encouraging and very open to any other suggestions of how to get the cross-pollination going.
But is the technical development working to timelines so that by the 27th of August or July, whatever, this is going to be done and that's going to be done and so forth?
Yes, and there's a man named Jeffrey Licht who has been the project manager for that group who's increasing his time in the coming months. He's an outside consultant from a group called Todd Consulting. Working with we're hoping to work with a very library-specific outside consultant to refine the technical architecture further, which was a suggestion from Mackenzie Smith, who's been working with us.
I didn't see that timeline. Is it out? Is it in the technical work stream?
I can go look on the wiki and see what's up there, and if there's not, we'll publish it. But there are lots and lots of timelines. And I think one of the issues here is there are lots and lots of meetings happening on this group,
mm-hmm.
and we want to know what you guys want to see. If you'd like to see every fine-grained development, we'll get those out. But we're seeking to share absolutely everything, you know, in every possible way. But I think a concern that we are not sufficiently focused on technical development would be an unfair suggestion.
I'm not suggesting that, but I'm not speaking only for myself in saying that it's obscure.
Yeah. No,
and yet in the development of both the back end and in the front end of this thing, set timelines for the pieces of this architecture seems to me crucial. Otherwise, we'll end up who knows where.
Yep. And having worked with this particular consultant, Jeff Licht, over a number of years, he's excellent at exactly that. So we are... I think, as I was describing to someone earlier, I think 90% of our time at the secretariat level, in addition to helping support all the meetings, is focusing on making sure the technical development has the setback time it needs to get to something good.
Okay.
But
So if we could see a schedule of deadlines that they're expecting to meet, and what will be accomplished in each of those deadlines. That seems like a fundamental need to be confident about this. And not only to be confident among ourselves, but people who are watching us, I increasingly hear, well, we're not quite sure what's happening. It all seems very vague and public presentations that suggest, yes, it will be successful, but we don't know how it's going to become successful.
So, I mean, that could take the form of a 1 to 2 page list of tasks.
please ask those on the call to mute again. We're getting a bunch of feedback. We will, within a week, Jerry, respond with a 1-to-2-pager with
great.
Some deadlines on technology development that will distill the very detailed spreadsheets into something that's human readable.
Okay.
Otherwise, you'll get more of it.
It's readable.
So, John, when you introduced this section,
yep.
You said there were three things. The first one was a working prototype. I think I know what that is.
Yep.
The third one was a work plan. I think I know what that might look like. And the second one was a something of which Europeana or Europeana West was an instance, and I didn't quite get what that one was.
Good. So
Europeana
that,
West?
Yeah.
Or the partnership with Europeana.
Oh.
This is to say, just what we've, and let me turn it over to Maura after this, but just let me restate my piece of it, is what we promised to the funders, which is the kind of the low bar that we need to clear, obviously we want to clear a higher one, was that we would have some content in a DPLA, and we promised a demonstration that was the partnership with Europeana. Our first MOU, as you know, right, is around migration and immigration. That's
okay,
the
fine.
We must
got
do
it,
it piece,
it,
and then it goes from there. But I do think that what we want to do is to do a good bit more than that,
yes.
And that's the number three discussion for today, but more if you want
to. And that's, you know, we have an agreement with Europeana to cooperate on a broad scale, and they regard this first step of doing an exhibition together, which is really a very small thing, as the first in many, many steps of things that we will do together down the road, and this should be much more of a gesture. They already have in place, they use Omeka, which was developed by, you know, Tom Sheinfeld and co. down at George Mason. They use that to do exhibitions. So they do this a lot. They have a formula for which they put on our exhibitions. So we are cooperating with them, and we'll have a small number of institutions contributing content on this topic. It will be highly curated. It will not be a huge, huge pool of data from the very beginning. But it will gesture towards what we could do in the future.
So it's a particular project that shows some capabilities.
It
yes.
shows some capabilities that connects the dots, that gestures towards what could be possible if you know, when we create a truly interoperable system, et cetera.
Can I ask, Maura, how it looks to you now? Europeana was interested in the migration side
yes.
of immigration, and we are too. The history of immigration in this country has become a social history of Europe with the Shtetl and all the rest of it. It's a wonderful, wonderful world of study. I'm a little concerned, I'm not informed, about how effectively Europeana has prepared its side of things. Where does it stand, is what I'm asking.
It stands, well, I know that they are in the process of identifying first the partner institutions that they would like to include in this. And from the partner institutions, one looks at the collections and identifies the big topics. So on our side, we've already identified the National Archives, Harvard's collection, the Open Collections on Immigration, the University of Minnesota, which has a very, very rich immigrant history research center, and the New York Public Library. So from our collections, we're looking now, first of all, we're looking for a curator, and that search is happening. But we're looking at what are the big topics that each of these collections have. Europeana is doing the same thing on their side, and then we're bringing those topics together and looking for the threads that match up.
Mark.
And we're handing that off to the historians and curators. Of course, we're doing the main, the bulking work in the beginning, but that will get much more fine-grained in the months ahead.
Excuse me, Dwight, just a second, following up. I mean, that is helpful. I once curated an exhibit for Vartan Gregorian, and it took 2 years of my life. It's an enormously intensive process.
Of course,
you're saying this is going to be modest in scale, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
But I think, you know, selecting a curator and then finding someone who can really devote a lot of time to this is crucial.
Well,
so I'm
spoken
a little
to
worried
Megan
about
here at the, you know, at the archives, at the Harvard archives. She's being very helpful with identifying people who know the collections well. The folks, Pam is probably on the phone. We've spoken about this. So
I am. We're eager to participate.
Yeah. So, Bob, if you really have a curating gig in mind, I might be able to hook you up.
He's retired from the curation business.
Yeah.
Okay, we have a page summary of this too. This is very interesting.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is fun, actually. So,
excellent.
Yeah.
So is technology development.
Yes. So is it.
All right, but Maura, you have signed up for the one pager on the Europeana.
I have?
Process.
Yes, I guess I have.
Okay. And I'm on the tech dev.
Okay.
Sorry, Maura.
Sorry.
I don't want to say anything negative about Europeana, but I'm a little worried about, you know, things falling between chairs.
You know, they just had an enormous meeting. They had their big three-day extravaganza. So they said that they were focused on that, and they will turn to this immediately upon, and that was last week, I suppose. So we have a call scheduled next week. Don't worry. We push them. Yep.
So this is good. I think to speak for those of us sitting in the Secretariat, we're acutely aware of the amount of work that has to get done between now and April 2013. We're trying both to set expectations in a reasonable place, but also plan to outperform in all of those ways. And we're particularly focused on those things that need time. They need setback and, you know, to be in motion. So I feel like, you know, we're talking about the big three, and the big three are the organizational structure, which I think we've ticked off. We are resetting the technology development to focus more on the front end, which we talked a little bit of now. We can go more into that if you like. And the third one really is the content aggregation, and a lot of that resides between the content and tech work streams, which are, working more closely together, and we'll continue to.
Yeah.
Those, I think, are the three things that need the most setback time.
Slightly related question. Has it been decided that it will be a Dublin core set of metadata? Is that with, presumably, the ability to expand the metadata categories?
That, I believe, is the premise that we continue to operate from.
With an
But if anything that has been notionally decided on the tech dev side is of concern, that's absolutely what should be raised with the tech dev work stream and kick through. But yes, we'll continue on that particular path. Ask whether there are other aspects of the work plan as stated that anybody would like to raise. Jerry raised a note earlier just before we were getting started that the draft user scenario's date of 7/27 seems wrong. I agree with that the expected start date is 7/27, that in fact the draft user scenarios are already drafted. So I think
that's a typo going on to the workshop, which is scheduled for 7/27. That's all.
And if anyone, use cases is something we put a ton of effort in, and if people have energy around it, we want your help. So there's tons of work to be done on that score. Bob, there were two items that you wished to raise that had not initially been on the work plan that we were going to add. One was the notion of having a means of raising money directly from the public. I don't know if you want to raise it at this point, or just want to make sure that we make room for it.
I think that there are great possibilities of accomplishing two goals by setting up an office or a special group or a committee or something like that to get this organized. The basic idea is to invite anyone to contribute money to the cause of the DPLA. And first of all, there is actually a possibility that a lot of money could flow in from this. The NEH has discovered that often the great American public responds in this way. So this is not a trivial thing. And secondly, it's a way to mobilize support for the DPLA and to spread word about its mission. So I think, this is a modest suggestion, but we could set up some kind of organizational structure and procedure for fundraising of this sort, private donations, as opposed to developing a plan for concerted donations from foundations. The second proposal is similar, and that is to similarly have whatever you want to call it, an office, a group that would be responsible for overseeing a plan for copyright owners to contribute their rights to a to the DPLA so that it could get on with making their books available. Of course, we have an enormous problem of making accessible to users this vast quantity of books that are, as we call it, out of print, or what Google says, not commercially available, but are covered by copyright. And one way to at least to begin with this dealing with this problem, not to solve it, but to help it make it less grave, is to encourage the copyright owners whose books have been out of print for a while to actually donate those rights to the DPLA. Now, Pam Samuelson has already developed an initiative about that, and there are other ideas, but I think we're at a point now where we could envisage two of these sub-functions as part of the DPLA.
So unless
Bob, this is Brewster. Are you proposing that people would donate their rights to the DPLA or would, say, declare them open?
You know, Brewster, I don't know what would be the best way to do it. I mean, the principle is that they would sacrifice exclusive rights to their works, but exactly what the form that should take, I don't know. I had thought that it would be open, and so it would not exclude the Internet Archive. I think all of us would operate from the premise that we don't want exclusivity of any kind, and also that this should be commercial. But I haven't got beyond that. Do you have thoughts on it?
We found the Creative Commons licenses to be very successful. You know, obviously this is an area that I'm concerned about. So, yes, being evangelical towards helping people want to declare their works open, I think, is a good idea.
Brewster, there have been two slightly further iterations on this. One is one that Pam Samuelson, I know, is pursuing through the Legal Aspects work stream to think about a way in which to be evangelical and to encourage, I think, particularly for starters, academic authors who we may have as our peers initially to make such contributions, and that's kind of one aspect of it. A second is a notion we've been working on a little bit at the Berkman Center here, which, as you know, is the home of Creative Commons licenses initially, to think about something called a library license, which would build on the CC framework to be an open commitment by authors of that sort. And we had a call, I think, yesterday or 2 days ago with Peter Brantley from your team soliciting views, and happy to talk with you more about this nascent effort. I think the basic idea is, can we set up an easy mechanism that people can rally around as authors, and where they might be able to make a commitment of works, either ones that have already been published or ones that will be published in the future, that would be brought open, on a CC-like basis. And the answer may be just use CC licenses, although I think my hunch is that doing something slightly more specific for authors that would be highly license interoperable, to use a Lessig term, would be a good strategy. But this is not deciding it as policy, but rather deciding that we ought to make this an aspect of it.
So. Yeah. So I guess mine is Paul. My view on this would be, this is a really good thing that DPLA could do, which is beat the drum, get people out there, explain to the world, if you authors, you rights holders, do this, whether it's a CC license or some variant thereof, then it's a better world. But the DPLA shouldn't be out there hustling for particular rights that it has in works that other people don't have in those same works. So it's really a complementary project. If it's terrifically successful, then we have a terrifically complete library, right? So that wouldn't that be cool? But I think it would not. I don't think the DPLA should become a holder of lots of rights, except in the nature of when you're in business, you wind up having some rights to some things.
Yeah. I think the principle of complementarity is one that we have banged the drum about from the start. I think this is you know, an important issue also between now and April 2013 is to work with HathiTrust and Internet Archive to determine what our relationship is and ideally to memorialize that as well in complementary terms. I think the other principle that we've clung to in, I think, positive ways, Brewster, you'll recall our tech dev meeting from last June, a year ago, when we noted the premise of taking no new rights, asserting no new rights at the DPLA level. I think that would go to, you know, not encouraging people to give exclusive rights to the DPLA in any event. We want to make the material broadly available.
So we have two projects going, and I think it's important to coordinate them and make sure that this works organizationally.
Yep, and we are absolutely on it with Pam in that respect, but I think it's super helpful to layer that into the work plan and make sure that people are comfortable with the general strategies.
Right now, we're talking this morning after breakfast about a problem that he sees frequently in public libraries, where they worry about losing control of their content. And I've seen that myself, even with the Nines project, trying to get people to aggregate in with us. So it seems to me, over this five-year plan, that one of the major efforts that DPLA ought to be trying to do is to work on the political problem among the smaller libraries to get them to buy into the benefits that come to them by aggregating their material. But when we were talking about it, Dwight said what people are afraid of is that they're going to be losing their jobs. And it seems to me that DPLA could enlist the people at the local level in the process of aggregating and digitizing this material without sort of putting them out of work, but in fact getting them involved in the building of the library.
Just so everyone knows, people on the call are having a hard time hearing, so those in the room,
we will
speak loudly
and
into mics.
Yes. That was another thing we spoke about at length in San Francisco, and I'm sorry you missed it because it was wonderful. The content and scope steering committee or work stream talked about this. Part of our long-term plan is to work very much on the state level for a lot of reasons. For sustainability, because states already have relationships with the biggest and the smallest of institutions. I know from my experience here in Massachusetts, there's a great program called the Digital Commonwealth that provides a whole laundry list of services to all libraries, museums, archives, the smallest historical society in the state. So you can have works digitized, you can have your data aggregated, you can have a metadata hit squad come out and help you. You know, there's a laundry list of things that happen, and the relationships work because it is on a local level. There's a personal connection. And I think I see this certainly as something that is a DPLA goal of shoring up existing either regional or subject-focused collaboratives, that kind of thing where you have those relationships in place. DPLA as a national probably cannot have a one-to-one relationship with every single institution, but you can have relationships with these either collaboratives or organizations that have that. And it's also the philosophical stance, I think, that everyone here agrees with, to be inclusive instead of just, you know, looking to get material from some large projects. You really want to be inclusive down to the last man.
Right.
So.
And I just to add to what Maura says, this is Amy Ryan from Boston Public, is that it also works because it is inclusive, but we do a lot of the heavy lifting in terms of the lab. So there's no sense in smaller libraries or institutions throughout Massachusetts having their digital labs. We play a coordinating role that could be a mini model for the DPLA.
Yeah, and in every state it looks slightly different. You know, the
Library
of Georgia has its home in a different, you know, each state has an anchor institution or two that play this role, like BPL.
Right.
So working on identifying who those institutions are and shoring them up is part of what we'd like to do.
There may be two other approaches as well. One would be an approach to help people who are right now really involved in institutions in a real basic clerical function to understand that through this project, they can become creators of content. They can go out and seek the content. They can establish relationships. They can do something broader than what they're doing now. And then another aspect might be on the scholarly level to generate the data or to make public the data more clearly, that usage actually increases of primary source materials when it is on a central site.
Yes.
So those are two things.
To communicate those is part of the work that we'll have to do better.
To do away with the fear.
Yeah,
that's great. If I may, just back to the was someone trying to jump in, Amy?
This is Kate Nevins. I'd like to make a comment from the field, if I may.
Okay, briefly would be great.
Okay, I just wanted to say first, we've been doing quite a bit of work recently just to inventory the literary groups and consortia that we're aware of across the country who are undertaking digital management for its members. And I think that would be something useful. I'll send that on to you all. The second thing is, I love this conversation about open and democratic, but I see that as being somewhat at odds with the initial effort in a carefully curated, narrowly selected subject area. And I think that this is something that where I feel the DPLA is projecting a little bit of a schizophrenic image of, is this something for which we want to encourage over time broad-based participation and contribution for what libraries in a distributed mode think is important? Or is this something for which we do want to have a coordinated, curated approach? I don't think that's an issue for resolution now, but I think there's some confusion among libraries in the field as to whether this is an opportunity for them long-term or not based on this dichotomy.
I would say, just to be to take the role of spokesperson for a second, Kate, for the purpose of this call and otherwise, is that the latter is absolutely the game plan. The game plan is to be a complementary project to all of the efforts to digitize materials very broadly in the United States. The Scanabago effort that we've been enthusiastic about is, I think, the sort of extreme form of that, but closer to home, the efforts of big institutions like Harvard and New York Public and Michigan and others to digitize large collections, to bring those together and to take advantage of the amazing models like the one that Amy has championed in the Commonwealth here and so forth. This is meant to be a broad-based effort. I don't think there's any schizophrenia on that score. And I think if we look to what we would love to do fundraising for, it would be to raise enormous amounts of money to do mass digitization across a very broad level and to create something that is a true national resource in that way. I think what you are reflecting appropriately is the challenge that we have in getting to day one. We do need to assert some amount of curatorial oversight or something that will get us to something that until we have that enormous database, that enormous
right.
amount of material that will be attractive to people and give them a sense of what, once we get to scale, this will be like and be able to function like. But I don't think there's any question but that this is a highly distributed project, one that is meant to be complementary and one that should be engaging to libraries, not off-putting. And yes, there will be moments along the way at which we have to do things in a way that are more tightly controlled and curated, but that's just because, as I think we've all experienced, it's very, very hard to operate with 1,000 people trying to move in the same direction.
Right. Well, I think it's great. You're very articulate on that topic, and I think we just need to be aware of some messaging along the way so people see the long-term view as well. So thank you for that explanation, John.
That's a great point, and thank you for reflecting what you're hearing also in the field. That's extremely helpful. One topic that I wanted, just for the next couple minutes, if I might, to pivot us towards, it's related to this plan, but I think might be useful to get to before we move to the partnership agreements, is the game plan broadly of engaging lots of different partners and thinking through how we get to something exciting in April, but which also points to the promise. So We will talk about this more specifically in the third segment around partnership agreements, but at least the working game plan has been that in the next 10 months, we will line up a group of institutions, and they will be ranging from small to large, who are going to agree to participate in some fashion with the DPLA. We will not be able to get all of their content, as it were, into the same system or rendered interoperable by April 2013, but I think we will be able to make a series of announcements between now and then that show the continuing momentum and, to get to Kate's point, which demonstrate the breadth and reach and involvement of a broad range of institutions. So just as examples of this, I think a success for DPLA will be if by April 2013 we can point to not just the continued promise, but in fact the notion that there are some key parties that have signed up, and some of which will have ideally shared some content, and others will be teed up to do that. So as one specific example, we have a new member of the steering committee, David Spadafora, who has joins us from the special libraries community, and I think will be very helpful in terms of getting the collections from special libraries into the DPLA world. If we were to sign up a series of institutions saying that they will contribute content, we won't be able to get all that in. I don't think to the alpha or kind of beta release, but we will have that teed up. We've had good discussions with and outreach from many aspects of the federal government, which has been a cornerstone of this project. But for instance, the group that runs science.gov has reached out to us about contributing some of their very technical materials, which are actually quite popular online materials. That would be an example of the enormous promise of government materials, and I note here Carl Malamud's important work in this general area. A third example would be large university libraries. This is something that where I think Bob's leadership, both at Harvard and nationally, is crucial, that to the extent that we can get large library systems like Harvard's and others to be sharing materials into the system, as well as obviously we've already done some metadata, and this will be important to coordinate with HathiTrust and others in that respect. So I think this is a very big piece of what we need to accomplish, and also what we need to convey to funders in the next 10 months is this overall game plan of lining up partners with respect to content, and doing so in a way that doesn't, I think, confuse people along the lines of what Kate was saying earlier, where, yes, there are lots of big institutions participating, but we also want the content of duly digitized and kind of local historical materials and other things that we from around the country and really reflect the diversity. So I think this is a very, very big theme for us, and I think is a segue between what we've got in the five-year plan and the final topic on our agenda.
Well, along those lines, it seems to me that, of course, we can't do, even attempt to do too much on April 2013 when we are open for business. And it would be a mistake to arouse unreasonable expectations. But on the other hand, we want to indicate the promise of this institution. One way to do it, I think, would be to have a concerted plan. We could call it a five-year plan or whatever, concerning content. And that would involve, I hope, examples of small public libraries developing their resources, developing outreach to their communities, taking over new curatorial functions that would empower the librarians working there. So that would be one aspect of it. And then you would have the independent research libraries, which often have great digitized collections of quite a spectacular kind. And I would hope that David Spadafora could take the lead in organizing them and have an actual sort of menu or calendar of special collections that would be made available to the public through the DPLA. And then, as you mentioned, John, the large research libraries all have special collections of a particular kind. And certainly at Harvard, we would be happy to make available collections which we've already digitized, and also to organize future digitizing with this kind of service in mind. So you could think of all of these aspects of the offering of content in the form of special collections being coordinated, and that you could have a calendar that would stretch over 5, maybe 10 years, with deadlines and indications of the actual material that would be made available. I think that's a way of indicating to the American public how rich this resource is going to be without promising too much.
Okay, well, we really are segueing from our five-year plan to the partnership agreement, which obviously there's a tight relationship. I'm going to formally do that, but just given this, and I want to maybe pick up exactly where Bob just left off, but since there are 2 minutes here, does anybody from the public or otherwise wish to comment further on the five-year plan?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Charlie, please.
Charlie Nissen here. I feel that April 13th is a makeable date for immense accomplishment. I think it only is a matter of deploying a template to which every library and school can contribute and could contribute by April 13. Specifically, if you think in terms of creating a digital registry which has layers, at its core, a curated, defended layer of public domain, at one tier out, a layer of Creative Commons, which doesn't come legally defended, it comes with risk. A further layer out of clear copyright. A layer beyond of contestable copyright. And the layer beyond that, orphan work. If we deploy this as a digital template and make it possible for libraries, schools, and individuals to contribute to it, there we have it.
I mean, it sounds good. I think that coincides very much with the sort of thinking that we've been developing all along. You could think of them as tiers, or you could think of a core with a series of concentric circles expanding outward. And the attractiveness of Charlie's proposal is that it's flexible so that the expansion can take place as we evaluate elements of risk and as we get closer towards solving some of the legal issues.
Oh, I like it in principle.
Charlie, this is Paul Couron speaking from great experience as well.
No experience hardly at all. the problem is that somebody has to certify that a given work falls into one of these boxes, and that turns out to be riskier than you might have thought. And so the question is, could we get good at it? If we got good at it, if we produced it reliably, if we produced, say, the Register of Copyrights to embark in a project like this with the DPLA, that would really be quite wonderful. If we're just one other outfit that's making informed guesses but still not carrying around the whole set of legal requirements for those informed guesses to be actionable by others, then I'm not sure it gets us very far. And I really think that's and whether it can be done in a way that's really reliable is the open question. It's certainly a good question for a Digital Public Library of America to consider.
Absolutely. Go ahead, Jordan. Please, actually, could you please speak up and make sure it goes in your mic?
Yeah. the Copyright Clearinghouse also does something similar.
The Copyright Clearance Center, they basically broker licenses. So that's really quite a different. So they're pretty clear on the rights they have to things, mostly. But they're basically saying, here's this work. It's in our registry, and you can pay a fee and then use it in a particular way. So it's not the right model.
You know,
the book rights registry that didn't happen with the settlement would have been such a model, and creating that would be a great thing.
I should say we've had very good conversations with CCC, copyright.com, through this process, Doran, and so we have a good open conversation with them. I think it is a slightly different model, and they have a charter through the public funds and so forth supporting it. So I do think that's kind of one angle, but not exactly the one Charlie and Paul are discussing. I do think this re-raises the importance of our engaging further with the Library of Congress and with the Register of Copyright. I think the best possible outcome along the lines of Charlie's suggestion would be, as Paul suggested, a partnership with the Register of Copyright to do this as a truly national resource, and I think we should work toward that. That seems evident and enormous. Yeah. It would be a huge success.
This is Brewster. I warn against this, I guess, in some of the same reasons that we've seen Hathi Trust get shot up over doing things that are really pretty uncontroversial, you'd think. So the idea of going back and doing the Books Rights Registry again, I think, is a bad idea. I think that inflames a lot of the general ideas that this is just the Google Books Project Part 2. I think there are other more successful ways that have been shown to work on the Internet. That's a little more notice and takedown approach and moving forward without engaging the Copyright Office in any way, and trying to build a glorified registry approach. I think we've seen that movie, and I think that's a dangerous direction for the DPLA to go in.
This is Brewster. So I think we've identified something that is something we should definitely talk more about in the legal work stream. That's plainly in scope for that group. I don't think in this steering committee call we're going to resolve the difference of opinion between, on the one hand, stated by Charlie, and the other hand, stated by Brewster, but seems like something the two of you certainly ought to discuss.
Sounds like we found something.
Into and through the legal work stream, and at the right time bring it back to the steering committee. It seems like something we should absolutely take up, but I think it's promising and important discussion point.
Well, may I just say this then, John?
You may.
And definitely, Phil speaking to Pam as well. For me, the goal, or at least a goal, an honorable goal of the Digital Public Library of America would be the clarification of digital space with respect to the law of copyright. And this requires more than just computer programming. This requires aggregation of good work by lawyers as well as by engineers. And I believe this is a soluble problem. The idea that the curated public domain collections of the great libraries can't be well defended seems not real to me as an obstacle, Brewster.
All right, well, I think that's beautifully put and an honorable goal indeed. Thank you for raising it, and let's talk more about it. And for those who are not familiar with Charlie Nesson's digital registry proposal, it was put forward also as a beta sprint as part of DPLA, and there's actually a fair amount of good material about it up, which is a subset of what Charlie just described, but an important one. Let me pivot now, just so we stay on track, to the last of our topics, which are these partnership agreements. And the subtext for this, as we put in the agenda, is the notion of ensuring continued provision of content. And I think it really goes to Kate Nevins's intervention in the last segment, as well as long-term stability of the DPLA. At least my hunch is that DPLA will thrive over time if it is an effort to which There's a commitment both on the part of people broadly because they use it and love it, and it's user-centric in that sense, as in serving real needs of people, but also to the extent that institutions that are in this business for the long term have committed to working together through this mechanism, and where institutions feel that they can succeed by virtue of doing that. And this is, in a sense, surfacing a discussion we've had at the governance workstream about the idea of partnership agreements. So we aspire during the next 10 months to sign up a number of institutions, whether they are large or small, public or private, to commit to contributing combination of content and metadata, and perhaps over time, although not articulated now, funds, whether in in-kind or literally, to the DPLA effort. Also, that we would figure out ways that the DPLA will raise money to support digitization that happens elsewhere, which is, I think, another means of tying partners in a long-term sense. So, as I think each of us probably has traveled around in the last few years representing one way or another the DPLA, we've had people say at great universities, yes, sign us up. What do we do to sign up? That's one example. I know there are members of the steering committee who have brought this. So we want to be able to answer that question and also do it in a way that is stable and sustainable. So let me put that topic out and welcome thoughts on this front.
We have some commitments already, do we not?
We have a variety of soft commitments, since nobody has signed a document, but there are many. I understand you've had interest from the University of Virginia. Mm-hmm. We've certainly had interest from Harvard University, and many others have come forward at various stages to say they would like to participate in a specific sense.
Dwight Maxwell, could there be different levels of partnership commitments?
Yep. To review what we've talked about before in the governance group, the idea is to establish a variety of different types of partnerships. I don't think there's probably one size fits all. So partnership could mean contributing, digitizing new materials and contributing it according to a standard to the DPLA, where you would, for instance, keep a copy locally at your university or your library and also make a copy available to the DPLA. Could be metadata plus minus as well, and it could be participating through other means, sort of TBD. I think we don't want to make this so complicated that it's 75 different levels. We need to focus on interoperability in this sense too, that we can actually make it work. I think a variant of this is also that some of our partners, I don't want to speak for Susan Hildreth too far or others, but people who are in funding positions like IMLS have looked at an NEH as well, to the extent that they are funding digitization efforts. Could they make, in the style of the NIH open access provision, when you digitize using dollars from foundations or the government, that you would make a copy available in a kind of standardized open format? That's another kind of version of these levels.
So are we contemplating, and maybe we don't have time to do this, but copy available in the sense that it's sitting on a server owned by the DPLA, or copy available in the sense that whatever the mechanism is by which people get this stuff through the DPLA, there will be a seamless or nearly seamless way of getting to the stuff? Those are really very different.
Yes, I think at a minimum the second one, but as you know, there have been strong calls by members of the steering committee that we actually have a means of bulk download. Carl, I think, has been most actively stating this. I think Brewster in various ways has too, such that we could imagine a world in which there we'd serve as a one node for copies of works that also reside elsewhere. And this may also go to the concern that Jerry noted before, which is I think we want to be sure that we are sending traffic back to places so that we're not costing anyone their jobs and making sure that people know that they get some credit. But I personally, I should say, and this is not an institutional statement, I see the value in the DPLA having copies of works for the purpose of reformatting for bulk download and so forth over time.
So the question is not only, there's one question in here is, what does it take to be a node in this node model?
Yeah.
And then the second question is, if you are a node, might that take the DPLA itself being a sort of super node?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, and my hunch is that the answer is both. That's an operating.
Yeah, personally, I sympathize with the notion of nodes and supernodes and also maximal cooperation with outfits like HATI and the Internet Archive. I should, just as an example, I mean, I've drafted a document which I would like the Harvard Library Board to officially approve. It might or might not serve as a model for other libraries, but it would commit Harvard to support the DPLA. It would spell out what that support means. And basically, it would begin with guaranteeing to provide, through whatever mechanism should exist, access to special collections. And there would be a kind of general statement of commitment. And then after that, there would be examples of these special collections we would make available. So I could imagine partnership agreements having a series of documents like that.
I want to acknowledge Bob and Paul, who are very kindly doing double duty today, running to another important meeting in another city. But Paul and Paul, thank you so much for being here in person, and particularly Paul, who's had to – you will be in probably three cities today. So
yeah.
One way or another. So thank you for that. Devotion to cause, much appreciated. We will share the next half hour of recording or so with you later. And again, thank you for your participation.
Bob, will you circulate that?
Yeah, I think we won't right away, Doran, because that's something that needs to be.
It'll take time, but it'll have to be really approved, maybe by the president.
But I think Bob's point is basically that we want to test out what could possibly be template for doing this elsewhere. But one of the difficulties of doing this project in public is that we also have to respect internal processes and so forth. So on that one, I think we're not going to share a draft until it's.
No, but it would be whenever it's ready, it'll be extremely useful to have the model.
Yep.
And if that were ready by April, and then could get signatories.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the idea. Because we're here and we can test it and see what reactions are internally, that may be useful. We have thought of an analogy, may or may not hold up for others, but both Bob and I have been deeply involved in the open access process here at Harvard. As you may know, the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and then subsequently the law school and other schools at Harvard made a pledge of all faculty members to make our scholarly articles available open access with a mechanism associated for opting out and so forth. This is something that we did, and others have done similar things, and we've all, I think, been in the process of sharing the documents to other schools, and I think there are there's a analogy here, which is if we can figure out from some of the sort of founding partners in DPLA what that looks like, and then have that template for others to sort of plug and play into, I think that will be very helpful.
And I think that would answer a lot of the April 13th sense of what do we have.
What do we have exactly?
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that we could say that we have is commitments on the part of a number of institutions, and I think some of them should be well known. Some of them should not be well known. Some of them, I think, should stand for the proposition of institutions that have really cool things, but not everybody knows, so that people will seek to join and see themselves in the model, basically.
Yeah. I think if DPLA just espoused certain principles, everybody would be a huge step forward.
Yeah. And demonstrating the importance and the commitment of doing things together. Or I don't know, do you want to talk at all about some of the things you're exploring with any of the other funders in a general sense? Is that useful to do now?
Well, I think that goes back to when Jerry and Dwight had the good questions about involving smaller institutions, because is that what you mean, talking about, we think that those principles of inclusiveness are extremely important. We think that driving home that, especially to the small institutions, that digital technology will not separate them from their users, but rather could help them by freeing them up to automate things that can be automated, but then allowing them to develop programs and doing community engagement around history and culture. And these are things that we see enormous potential for in DPLA. So I know that I would personally love to see every single state have its DPLA data hub, where, or not even a data hub, we call it a hub, and we define a list of services that each DPLA hub should have, and those are the things that we know. There's digitization and metadata help for the smaller institutions and aggregation and so on, and that, you know, we work really hard on trying to find the anchor institution, like in Massachusetts, the Boston Public Library, that is an institution that will be around for a long time and that has staff or resources that it can devote to it. And you need that anchor. And that becomes, that each one of these becomes a thriving local center, not only for getting stuff done, but also for that community engagement. We also think, and what I have seen in the work, you know, that we've done in DPLA and in previous, is that once you get these smaller institutions on board with the basic digitization of collections, that's an on-ramp into much larger issues, and that, you know, the issues of rights and the issues of how to work with copyright and all of that becomes, you know, it becomes an educational tool as well. So there's a huge benefit for that. There's a huge benefit for funders, too, to be able to say, that's a wonderful project. We'd love to fund that, and we will fund that if, you know, you commit to contributing it to your local DPLA node, so that the greatest bang for the buck can be had in terms of public good. You want to build something that where it's easy for funders to contribute to that public good, and not just by funneling money to one central organization, which no one here wants, but rather by pushing money out, you know, call it under the DPLA umbrella, to any number of organizations that can do work that will not then be isolated and siloed. So we are talking to funders about getting a series of 6 to 8 pilot, you know, test sites.
States
at this point. You know, there are wonderful collaborative projects like the Biodiversity Heritage Library and the Medical Heritage Library and others that might become contributing nodes, but at this point we're looking at states.
Yeah,
and trying to get that off the ground before April. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
It seems to me that if the 2013 launch had 2 or 3 state organizations.
How about six?
As many as, where, in fact, getting them involved would get them involved in working out the kinds of agreements that they're going to need, and the different types of agreements that different kinds of states, depending on how large they are, how small they are, how wealthy they are, how not wealthy they are.
I vigorously nod and say yes, and that's one of the things. Emily Gore has been hugely helpful in putting together a survey that we've pushed out over various lists to LSTA-funded collaboratives, to other groups that have been working together to figure out what is on the ground already. Once again, DPLA doesn't want to, you know, put a spade in the ground and build something new, but rather build bridges or shore up things that exist already. And we're collecting the data so that we might be able to get that done quickly.
And this is Dwight McInville.
Yep.
I'd just like to underscore what you just said about Emily Gore.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful person. I think she may still be on the line, and so she should be getting a good swelled head, but it's a deserved swelled head.
Yeah, no, she's been fantastic.
She's fantastic.
Yeah.
We love Emily Gore.
Emily Gore is fantastic.
For
the record.
Scanabago.
Okay.
But yeah,
so
I think
I'll send you the.
Yeah, I would like to see.
I think everybody gets the gist of what we want to accomplish. There's a lot of work to be done to do that, but I hope that it would send the right message, both to potential participants and to the public about what we aspire to do, and I think it will put some sense of clarity around what the DPLA will be over time.
Are we going to try then to work, or are you all in the Secretariat going to be trying to work out agreements for different kinds of possible nodes, that is, you know, universities, small colleges? I mean, there are, everyone has a different set of requirements, needs,
the content and scope work stream is focused on that. And, you know, from our perspective, we realize we can't have a gazillion different agreements.
Right.
And so one of the easier ways is to, or one of the smoother ways, is to use states already. Again, in Massachusetts, the Digital Commonwealth aggregated data from, you know, the Medford Historical Society up to the University of Massachusetts, in theory. I know not everyone is in yet, but that could be another on-ramp where, you know, if you as a university want to participate, that you make your data available to that local or state hub.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way. Then there are larger, you know, there are, I think it's a function of size as well in some cases.
So, Jerry, the exactly what we're talking about is we want to get comfortable with the strategy. If everyone could use that, getting a ton of feedback from somebody, muting would be awesome. As usual,
I'm sorry, we're
someone has got a ton of. Please, everyone, mute if you would. Thank you. We're delighted to have the presentation. Anyway, so yes, we want to optimize for this balance.
Mm-hmm.
And the content group and Maura and Emily Gore and others, I think, are going to be taking the lead on this front. And we'll, if UVA or others actually would be willing to be test cases, that could be
looking for friends and family,
yep.
You know, people that we can work with on the agreements and,
yep.
And
okay.
Have that kind of feedback. Okay, why doesn't this work for you? Can,
yep. That could be very good to do. Someone trying to jump
Kate
in this Amy? Kate,
yeah.
Kate, uh-huh.
Thank you. It's been great to hear this discussion about nodes, and the only observation I would make is the topography of cooperation in every state is so different. In some cases, state libraries do play a central role. In some cases, they don't have capacity in this area, and I think that it would be really useful as we look at Emily's work to ensure that we don't put a finger in the middle of a complicated situation between sometimes rival, sometimes cooperative activities underway in each state. So I just would recommend some caution there.
Kate, we are definitely on that. We definitely hear you. And
great.
And our
well put.
And yeah.
We're in 5 minutes, we're going to open this up to everybody. So if
oh,
I might,
sorry.
For the next 5 minutes, just to keep privileging the steering committee, your suggestions are all awesome, Kate. I just want to make sure we, for those on the phone, the steering committee, if we can.
So, Maura, we can help you with those agreements, too, because we've started working on those with our Library for the Commonwealth initiative, too.
Boston Rock, we appreciate that because we know you
yeah.
have a lot of experience.
Yeah, we're happy to be participants in that.
Once
thank you
come
Amy.
Back from vacation, Amy.
I know.
We've got a couple minutes left devoted to this session. Are there other things that steering committee members wanted to respond to any of these topics before we open it for public comment?
Yes, this is Brewster. John, I think I can speak for Carl Malamud. The idea of allowing bulk download does not mean that the DPLA needs to host these materials.
You're breaking up. Sorry, Brewster.
I don't think that implication, which definitely up for bulk downloading, but I understood DPLA as going to be a metadata function and a coordinating function as opposed to building a hosted organization, library itself. So I think that just as a point of interest.
It is a point of interest. As you know from our West Coast meeting, Brewster, that's there's not a uniform view on this exact topic. I think everybody agrees that it ought to be a metadata service. I think everybody agrees that it would be a mistake to seek to build the end-all, be-all library, which you have, I think, made very clear to the group. I do not think everybody agrees with you that the DPLA should in no instance have copies of materials. So I think that is a point that we do not all agree on, and we'll have to resolve by April. Other comments that anyone wants to put on the table? Great. I think we should then pivot to what our last order of business is to, as the steering committee, welcome open discussion as well as public comment between now and 12:15 p.m. Certainly, I think those who have been on the line know quite well what we have been paying attention to as a steering committee from these three topics. There are many other topics, of course, we've been focused on. We welcome commentary on any topic, but in particular the ones that we've been discussing today. And please, too, if you're willing to say who you are.
David Rothman. Am I on?
You're recognized, David Rothman.
Thanks, John. I think Brewster could be a great contractor in so many ways for the DPLA. He really is one of the grand old men, if Brewster, no insult intended, of the archive world. At the same time, I don't think that Brewster, in effect, should help set national digital library policy. I think, to the extent that maybe he, in effect, envisions, I think the DPLA should allow lots and lots of local autonomy and work closely with Brewster and maybe even send a lot of business his way. But I think there should be, in addition to local resources, respecting local autonomy, there should be a secure national digital library system with its own servers, and this is really important in the era of network books. And, you know, we want stable links. We want components of the network books to last. So those are my thoughts, and I hope Brewster will keep an open mind on this. There could be a lot of opportunities for him.
Thank you, David. And Brewster, you're most welcome to respond or not as you prefer.
Oh, I think it's scoping what it is the Digital Public Library of America is and how it's going to interact with the existing library system. And I think that's the how centralized and sort of is this thing going to be? That is, I think, one of the absolute key questions. The other is the DPLA, how is it going to try to shape, if at all, copyright policy? So those are issues that I think have always been underlying these conversations. And I agree that there should be many libraries. And are we building towards that future?
Great, thank you. May I recognize anyone else from the open discussion public comment end?
Hey, David Curry.
I'm sorry, David Curry, go ahead.
Thank you. During the conversation, I had a chance to open the Excel file with the five-year plan, and I don't want to go back into the weeds on governance, but it strikes me that the representation about the new board, which has line items for nominations and elections and inaugural board meeting, seems to have a very short timeline indicated by the color bars. And the earlier discussion seemed to me that with a nominating committee sort of information in a week and board nominations, et cetera, that could move forward rather more quickly than by the end of the year or by next April. So I'm not sure if this is a governance work stream matter, but it was sounding as if the steering committee and the secretariat might be quite expeditious in moving forward with the board in getting the 513 filed in Delaware, et cetera. And I'm just noting that I'm not sure I heard when a target for the board being in place and an inaugural board meeting to actually occur, but that will represent a very interesting crossing point for fiduciary responsibility and other things that are in sort of the transition area. So I guess it was partly a question.
Yep.
And so I'll leave that question. The other thing that I just wanted to mention is that, John, in your very helpful email positioning some of this, the one thing that I'm not sure I heard the steering committee speak to specifically, except perhaps that the board should be small and tactically able, is your sentence that suggested that the job of working out a charter and bylaws has been assigned back to the governance work stream, but we, the steering committee, I presume, ought to give clear guidance as to the principles that guide this work. So I heard small. I heard committee structures which might involve non-board members. But I'm wondering if that direction or guidance had as much conversation. Perhaps I came on the call a little bit late, so excuse me if I missed that. So one was a question about timing, because there's a very interesting toggling of what the board is actually responsible for when it comes into being, including financial grant monies, et cetera. And the other is the principles that the development of the bylaws and the articles of incorporation should follow. And I can hear that threaded through actually all of the conversation, including even the partnership agreements, but just wanted to touch to come back to that governance section just for a bit. Thank you.
Sure, David. Thank you. So clearly the five-year plan needs some date adjustment based on what we've discussed, and so we'll recirculate the spreadsheet after we've changed some dates. So point well taken that that's now mooted in a way, or at least obsolete in the way that it appears now. In terms of the hustle, I think we really very much do want to have the new organization up and running by 12/31/2012. That's our current plan. That's faster than what we put in our initial grant proposals to Sloan and Arcadia, but it's where what we're aiming for, and we think that's both appropriate in terms of being deliberate and appropriate in terms of being urgent. You noted the important moment of handoff of fiduciary and otherwise. I think we at the Berkman Center would like to hand off formal decision-making as soon as we possibly can to a new, empowered, clear board and executive director. We also plan to be a support network for the DPLA in whatever form it has assumed for, as long as necessary, for a year plus, if that's what it takes. So we'll figure out how to do that over the, appropriate span of time. And the point here is not to retain authority, but rather just to be sure that the thing is well supported and has the team and so forth that it needs. So I would distinguish a little bit between decision making and authority and governance and fiduciary responsibility switching to the board and the new board and the new organization and some of the tasks that we in the Berkman Center will continue to perform behind the scenes to make sure things go. So that's I hope responsive to your first point. Second one, as to principles, you're quite right that we didn't go into specific principles to give back to the governance work stream, but I think we did speak to it, as you noted, throughout. I think we've defined a number of parameters. My sense would be that we will have an initial charter and bylaws that will be relatively straightforward and simple, and that when the new board is in place and the new organization has gotten up and running, that as with many organizations, that there will be a moment of reviewing the bylaws and the charter after it's up and running. So I guess my instinct is that we have the kind of basic pieces where obviously the government's work stream will need to come back to the steering committee with its recommendations on a charter and bylaws and so forth. So there will be a chance to give more feedback to it, and we would assume that it's not set in stone when we first file it with what sounds now like the Delaware authorities. Anyone else like to jump in? Thank you to the two Davids so far. I thought I heard some other voice at the time that David.
Yeah, this is Emily.
Hi, Emily.
Hey, I just wanted to address Kate's concern a little bit about the broad participation. So I just wanted to let her know that the results I've been getting back in the surveys, there were two surveys, one targeted at LSTA and funding and how LSTA dollars are being used to fund digitization very differently in many states. And so that those results are quite interesting. Some states are not using any LSTA money, and then some have really in-depth regraining programs. So all of that is coming back. And the survey of the collaboratives themselves was not at all limited at just state collaboratives, but regional and genre-specific and otherwise. So we are getting broad data from the collaborative organizations as well. So hopefully what we get will be broadly representative.
Great. Thank you so much, Emily.
No problem.
Emily, Kate, I apologize for if I did cutting you off earlier. I just wanted to make sure that everyone had a sense of the parameters of timing. But was there anything further that you wanted to raise when I rudely cut you off?
Yeah. No, I do have one other point, and I apologize for not getting with the program in terms of my timing of comments, but I think I've got it figured out now, so thanks for your patience. The other comment that I wanted to make was to circle back on the partner concept, and I think we had a really good discussion about the partner concept related to nodes and metadata and content creation, but as a really interested partner, my interest also includes a partnership agreement that is almost a certification, if you will. That is a commitment to the DPLA that organizations and libraries can use so that they can pursue activities that would be useful. Let me just give you an example. We at Lyrisys are very interested in using our longtime success in grant seeking to get funding for libraries related to DPLA contributions. So to have a partnership agreement that says we have made these commitments and that we can say to funding agents that we are kind of an official partner, if you will. And that's a little bit different than the kind of partnership you all were talking about earlier. So I just would like to get that into the thought process.
Thank you.
For your thinking. Thanks.
Very, very helpful, and we're delighted that people wish to be partners, and we're grateful so far. As I think everybody knows, Lyrisys has been doing some work with us, and we're thrilled to have that and figure out how to memorialize that more publicly. Sounds like a good idea. To the extent that there are others, we should make that possible. So thank you.
Thanks. And we're interested in leveraging all the good work that's gone on so far to extend participation and support, and we think we can do that as a partner.
That's fabulous. Thank you. Other commentary from the public?
Yeah, it's Matt Burrows again. I have a question. I just want to follow up on Brewster's comment about, in essence, the overall purpose of DPLA. As a formal matter, where is this conversation being had with respect to metadata and content? Is that in a particular work stream? I mean, because the only thing I can identify here, just on the website, is the content and scope work stream.
It's largely there, and it crosses over into the technical work stream at a specific time.
Yeah, so I would say that this is a topic that we have taken up in probably every steering committee discussion one way or another, and I think there are, there continue not to be there continues not to be a single view on this. I think there is a range of views. I think the vetting of it has been taking place also in the content and scope workstream and the tech workstream, and it is something that we are we're going to have to resolve at least as an initial matter. And some people are going to disagree by definition because there are quite strong different views on it.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Other comments? Members of the steering committee, anything you would like to raise as a not so precluded? All right. I think this silence is a sense that we ought to close the meeting officially. It's 11:57 Cambridge Mass time. Particular thanks to those in other time zones. I think Brewster's it's time for breakfast on his end. Thank you to everybody who has joined in, both steering committee and otherwise. This has been an extremely helpful conversation, and thank you to those who in the future will be playing this recording. We send you wishes from the past. Thanks, everyone. We'll see you soon. Take care.
Thank you, John, and
thank
Maura
you.
And everyone. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.